accession number 8337, reel 2.
General Graham, reel 2. Now, the second lesson I learnt very early on in my experiences in Normandy was that if you have a built-up area in which there are enemy and you bombard it, either from the air or by naval guns or by land artillery, the chances of doing much damage to the enemy therein are really quite small. But what you will do is to create for your own advance an almost insuperable barrier. And yet it's something which we continued to do, and it caused us a lot of hardship in the months to come, and of course great grief and destruction to the owners of the properties we knocked down. I suppose the prime example of this was the monastery at Monte Cassino.
Just going back to something you said earlier about the Norwegian farmers showing displeasure.
Normandy farmers.
Normandy farmers. In what way did they show this displeasure? How did it manifest itself?
Sullenness. I spoke French quite well. I find it very difficult to get them to converse. If one wanted to buy eggs or apples or whatever for the messes and so on, it was not easy extracting these things from them. But I must say that this attitude was really limited to the Normans in Normandy and, of course, elsewhere in France and so on. They became really extremely grateful and happy and enthusiastic.
Did anybody actually say, "Why don't you lot go home," or express pro-German?
Not to me. But one used to hear stories about people who were actively assisting the Germans. And I think it's only to be expected. The Germans had been there for many years. They had behaved themselves extremely well. The German infantry were very largely from peasant stock who settled down in these farms and helped milk the cows and cut the corn. And as I say, we did none of these things. All we did was destroy.
What happened next?
In this battle, Operation Epsom?
Yes.
Well, we went through Cher. The 10th Battalion, the Highland Light Infantry, and the 2nd Argonne Sergeant Highlanders went through Cher on two different axes, groped our way forward, again tending to shoot at each other, thinking we were under fire from Germans up on either tops of trees or tops of what remained of the buildings. However, we got through somehow, and we found a track which led, we discovered later, down the boundary between two German formations. And although the two battalions of our brigade, the 2nd Gordons and the HLI, got a considerable amount of stick, the HLI were caught by tanks on their start line and hardly got going at all. The Gordons got into a village called Culville, but got driven out again with some loss. We managed to find this track which went between the two, and we advanced almost without opposition through Colville, over the main road to Caen, and we took the bridge at Tourmaville. A wonderful dash by C Company in the carrier platoon commanded by Major Hugh Fife. He got an MC for this. And we captured this vital bridge over the River Oden at Tourmaville for the loss that day of 3 men killed and 11 wounded. And we consolidated, and about half an hour later, up came the motor battalion and tanks of the 11th Armour Division, and they passed through, and we cheered, and we all said, "Next stop, Paris." This was the aim of the whole operation, to make a breakthrough of the Canadians and to go right down and capture the bridges over the Oden. And we did it. But what happened? There was a Panzergrenadier battalion dug in
at point 112, this big feature you see here south of Burrell. And we were at Turmerville. And they got that far, and they got no further. Indeed, nobody got any further for another month. And the 43rd Division, up coming up on our left, they couldn't shift them to the back of 112.
How much of the enemy did you actually see?
Hardly anything. Very, very thick country. Remember, we're talking about the last week in June. The corn was standing 4 foot high. It hadn't been cut. The trees were in full bloom. The ditches, great deep ditches between these enormous Norman hedgerows. Excellent cover for the enemy. And they, of course, had first class, as they call it, tarnung, camouflage, their equipment and so on. One hardly saw any enemy movement at all. Tanks, yes. Vehicles occasionally. And aeroplanes, frequently. And I'll tell you an interesting thing. We had, of course, total air superiority. But the fact is that almost every day in that first operation, there were three German aircraft circling up there. Nobody interfered with them. They didn't do much to us, but they were there. And almost every night, somebody in the beachhead was bombed. And indeed, the worst casualties that we suffered in Normandy were from a night bombing attack about 6 weeks later near Caumont. So, although we undoubtedly had air superiority with spelt with a capital S, it does not mean that the enemy air force ceased to exist. It was there. And we saw them, and they saw us.
What was your opinion of the performance of the German troops against whom you were fighting?
Very good. They were, of course, a mixed bag. We didn't have to fight any of the coastal divisions, because that was the job of the 3rd Division, the Canadians, those who'd landed on D-Day. We came up against people further inland. It was, I must say, shattering to go back some years later with the Staff College from Camberley and study the Battle of Epsom operation, and to discover that the main opposition up against which 15, the whole of our division, 15 Scottish, had been, consisted of a divisional engineer regiment and a regiment of artillery, which had a rather switched-on commanding officer who gripped the whole situation. So basically, until we got to there, that is all we've been up against. But they put up a good show.
Until you got to the river.
That's right. And then they produced some tanks too. But the Germans, you see, find themselves faced with an intrusion, what the British press called the Scottish Corridor, what some 5 miles of Scottish spearhead, and we, the 2nd Argylls, were the point of that spear right down there, and the Canadians are way back. And we got this bridge at Turmerville, and the next day we're told to move across to the village of Gavras down here and take that bridge as well, which we did. And we got there without too much trouble. And dug in. Then, of course, the following afternoon, there came, at 2:30 in the afternoon, from the southwest, a counterattack. These were the 9th and 10th SS divisions that had made their way from South Russia. Frunzberg and Hohenstaufen, two SS divisions. And after considerable difficulties en route, and of course attacked some Allied air force and so on, they had come. And they put in an attack from the southwest against us at Gavras and against the 7th Seaforth at Levaltru, just behind us. And they were very good. The country was so close, you couldn't see more than a few hundred yards. And the first that the 2nd Argylls knew about this attack
is that the company commander forward, Bill McElwee, who's now dead, who's a master at Stowe, very brave chap, he went up to visit one of his leading sections. And he found them 2:30 in the afternoon, kipping in the sun. And he looked over the hedge, and about 300 metres away, coming towards him, he saw the odd tank and many, many half-tracks, with the Germans sitting inside, holding their rifles, as if they were on a sort of parade. The Germans didn't know we were there, and we didn't know they were coming. But, of course, he woke his company up, and we had quite a battle for about 48 hours. And the Germans were good. They didn't penetrate our positions. We lost quite a lot of people, particularly from mortar fire. I know we destroyed some tanks around Gavras. The 7th C4th Levalchou had a lot of casualties and inflicted a lot too. They had a splendid commanding officer called Aeneas Grant, a great tall chap, and he used to walk round with his crummock, which is his big Highland officer's stick. And I'm told that he'd go to one of his young soldiers with a Piat, which was the Protector Infantry Anti-Tank, and that ghastly weapon which we had to fire against tanks. He'd say, "Do you see that panther over there? I'll give you 10 bob if you hit it." That sort of thing. This is the story that went round. Anyway, the C4th held. They did very well. And we held. And we were slightly surprised about 2 days later to be withdrawn back behind the railway at Colville, because it was alleged that this bridge at Gavras was no longer needed. What had happened, of course, that the whole offensive, Epsom, the breakout battle, had petered out, because the armour, having got through our position across the River Roden, couldn't get past the Panzergrenadier and 112 and the remainder of the SS who were coming up to block this particular thrust. And this was a story which was to be repeated throughout the campaign. And it is admirably brought out, if I may say so, in a book which Max Hastings published about 2 months ago, called Overlord and the Battle of Normandy. And you asked me about 10 minutes ago about the professionalism of the German soldier. Well, I haven't really answered the question yet, but I will now. I believe that they were unquestionably the best army in the world. They fought extremely well and with great skill. Their use of ground was remarkable. Their ability to plug gaps by quite junior commanders taking the initiative, not waiting for orders from on high, was far superior to ours. And of course, much later, when the German army had been defeated in France and pulled back over the Seine, and we chased them into Belgium and Holland, their ability to get a cohesive defence line up against us by bringing in remnants of regiments and batteries and squadrons and falling them in, saying, "Right, what's your name, Captain? Schmidt. Right. You and these 100 men are battle group Schmidt. What's your name, Major? Kruger. Right. This lot is yours, battle group Kruger." And with these battle groups, organized on an ad hoc basis, they produced a pretty resolute and swiftly organized defense. We, of course, with our individual cap badges and our more peculiar loyalties, would tend to disregard anybody who didn't wear the same cap badge. Much more insular. It had its strength, but certainly in a defensive battle, such as the Germans are having to wage, our system produced its weaknesses. And I think this was found in the Western Desert. I didn't serve there, but I think we were a bit rigid.
Why was the Piat so ghastly?
In order to cock it, you had to compress an extremely stout spring. To do this, you really had to stand up and by a combination of shoulder and footwork, compresses, well, because you can't stand up on the battlefield more than once, normally. And so doing it lying down was quite difficult. If a blade of grass or a twig got in the way, the fuse was very sensitive, it tended to blow up long before it reached the target. It was a very crude weapon, and it did in no respect match the Panzerfaust with which the German infantry were equipped. And I must say here and now, of course, that the equipment of the German soldier, of course, gave him an advantage over us. I think his personal equipment, that is to say his gas mask and his leather belt and the way it was slung round him, was rather less cumbersome than our own. His helmet fitted the head better and stayed on. I always thought that one of the great disadvantages of being an infantryman in this last campaign was that steel helmet which we had, which was a relic of World War I, designed really to stop shrapnel coming down into a trench from above. But it was a helmet which, if you ran, toppled, or if you lay down, got tilted over your eyes by the small pack, which is on your back. It was not a comfortable or really very efficient helmet, nor could you wash in it. As regards weaponry, of course, there's no doubt that the German Mark VI Tiger tank and the Mark V Panther were far superior to anything the Allies had, be they Churchill's or Sherman's or Cromwell's. Not only did they have thicker armour, but of course their gunnery. They were upgunned, very good guns, the 75 and the 88mm. And they could destroy our tanks at ranges, and our tanks couldn't touch them. And of course the infantry in the Spandau, the MG-42, the Germans had a machine gun, very robust, extremely reliable, belt-fed, 1,200 rounds a minute, caused great execution, less accurate, I think, than the Bren, but you don't need accuracy. You're not trying to get a 6-inch group at 500 yards of the battlefield. You're trying to spray an area and frighten a great number of men behind a hedge or in a building or in a field. And that the Spandau could do. And being belt-fed, of course, they could join the belts together. They could fire for 20 to 25 minutes, if necessary, until the ammunition ran out. We, with our Bren gun, a very good weapon, fired either single shots or bursts, as please, but dependent on a magazine which held 28 rounds. Now, moving over country, men becoming killed and wounded, the magazines spread around the section, their pouches. I mean, it was simply not feasible to go around all the corpses and the wounded and extract their magazines. So although you started off a battle with a full complement of filled magazines for all the Bren guns in the company, by the time you got to the objective, or whatever, you didn't have them with you. So there's always the problem of filling the magazines and ensuring you had enough.
You've talked about the advantages of the Germans over the Allies, but what were the advantages of the Allies over the Germans?
Numbers, materiel, air superiority, and artillery above all. And I think all infantrymen who fought in Normandy would say, whether they're American, Canadian, Polish or British, would say the weapon, the regiment, which really enabled us to get to our objectives and hurl them was the Royal Artillery, first class, the 25-pounder gun, and above all the 5.5 medium gun. 25-pounder shell was a bit light, but the 5.5, very effective. And, of course, in the early stages, we had the guns of the fleet and certain heavy batteries in addition. But from time to time, the Germans produced a lot of artillery. For instance, our second battle down here, where we lost the brigade commander at Baron, that had been a German corps headquarters, and all their artillery from the other side of the River Orne concentrated. It was an extremely unpleasant experience being in this town under German shell fire. But to be under German artillery fire of that weight and duration was a very rare experience, very rare, whereas the Germans had it from us constantly.
Going back to the narrative, was that the end of the Operation Epsom then, as far as you were concerned?
We were then pulled back until the bridge at Gavras and Tormovo was no longer needed, and I think the 53rd Welsh Division took over some of this area. And then shortly afterwards, we were told to do another operation in the same sort of area called Green Line, which really was a most unfortunate experience. It's a very curious thing how superstitious soldiers are. One is naturally superstitious about things like walking under ladders and single magpies and so on. And, of course, I never expected to come through Normandy because it struck me that every time one went anywhere, there was a single magpie just up the road ahead of you. Never two or three, just one magpie. But that didn't seem to actually mean much because I'm still here. But what we did find is if we were due to carry out an operation under a particular corps or corps commander, we either knew it was going to be extremely successful or a bloody Horlicks. Well, we say in the army, no names, no pack drill. But there were certain corps we were delighted to actually perform for and under. But there were others, if we heard that we were going to take part in an operation planned by them, we dreaded it. It's a curious thing, and it's probably grossly unfair, but it's a feel what the soldiers get. And I tell you another thing. Sunday was always the busiest day. Every battle seemed to start on a Sunday. All the major moves happened on a Sunday.
All the major?
Moves. Occurrences. Sunday was not sacrosanct at all. Sunday seemed to be rather a busy and unpleasant day.
Do you think it was picked deliberately?
No, not at all.
Why was Operation Green Line so bad?
Well, firstly, a great number of troops had to form up in a very small, albeit wooded area, round the village of Baron, B-A-R-O-N. And they were made to form up too early in the evening, and the Germans on the high ground on the other side could see it, and the Germans had a lot of artillery and used it. But that was all right. I had to guide our battalion in the darkness through the wreckage of the village of Baron up to the start line to do an attack behind the Gordons and the HLI in the southwestern direction towards a town called Bougie. In general terms, this is what was the aim of the operation. But the troops that had been on the ground before, holding the FDLs, had scattered minefields, and these minefields had not been properly recorded. The result was that only one gap had been cleared in the minefield and marked by our own sappers to get the whole of a brigade plus its tanks and its carriers, through. Well, we got through. And then started in the darkness to go down the forward slope of a bare hill. The 2nd Battalion, the Gordon Highlands, leading. They got held up by a stream, which only seemed to be a ditch on the Eiffel de Graaf, but in fact proved to be a much more serious obstacle, somewhere just off the map down here. And, of course, with fixed-line fires, again from our friends on point 112, the Germans, across their back.
They were firing roughly west.
Yeah. They got no further, the Gordons. But in the meantime, the whole of the rest of the brigade and its tanks was closing up behind them. Now, one of the difficulties of fighting in Normandy at that time of year was the hours of darkness were very short. This was a particular strain in commanding officers because they really had very limited hours of darkness in which to sleep. Well, it was dawn about 5, and there we were, the whole of a brigade, plus its tanks and transport, on the forward slope, with all the Germans the other side looking at us, and one gap in a British minefield through which to go back. And that gap got blocked because the tank went and blew itself up. And dawn came up,
and we felt very exposed. And somehow we dug slits and sort of took cover, and we were there for a number of hours until people said, well, this simply will not do. We must cancel this operation and pull everybody back. And the only way we got away with it, because the Royal Artillery, I'd mentioned them a short time ago, fired for about 4 hours incessant smoke over us, over the river, onto the Germans. But the Germans missed a great opportunity. They could have slaughtered us.
Were there many casualties in it in practice?
No. We were remarkably lucky. But it was an ill-conceived operation.
You talked about the units you were happy to serve with. Which were they? Can you recollect?
Oh, yes. Well, you're getting now on the subject of personalities. There has been a lot of writing and a lot of controversy on the radio, for example, in the last few years about the relations between Montgomery and Eisenhower and others. All I can say is the Commander-in-Chief of 21 Army Group, in other words, our boss, General Montgomery, was regarded by us as the finest soldier in the world. If we were going to be in a battle, which he had planned, there would be no guarantee that as individuals we would come through, but no question about the battle not being won. With total confidence, absolute confidence in his curious little man, whom we used to see in England before we even set out for France.
How much personal contact, if any, did you have with him?
No more than any other young officer or soldier. But he made a point of coming to see all his units, and we all gathered round the jeep, and he stood up and he addressed us in England and again on occasion in France.
Why do you say curious little man?
Well, he was not large, and some of his habits were different from the run-of-the-mill regular officer. He was very perky. And he had this beak-like nose and a piercing eye and a rather high, shrill voice. And his manner of speaking was very sharp, very incisive. The others were not. He was an outstanding man. And we loved him.
Did some people find him abrasive?
Oh, I'm sure they did, those that worked with him. But at our level, and I'm talking about a normal infantry regiment, he was our commander-in-chief. He'd won the Battle of Alamein. He'd seen them out of Sicily, and he'd invaded Italy, and he'd come, and we'd invaded Normandy with success under him, and we were going to win the war. And some of the corps commanders. General Dempsey, the army commander, we knew very little about. I think he was a retiring fellow, but highly competent. Obviously, highly competent. The first corps commander, General Sir Richard O'Connor, who'd done so well in the desert and then escaped after being taken prisoner, he commanded 8 Corps. We started Epsom under him. He was a little terrier of a man, had been a Cameronian. We thought the world of him. And indeed, we used to see a lot of him. We were under him later on in Holland. I remember a day in Holland, terrible, awful weather it was, about November 1944. There he was, as we were advancing towards the Maas, in an armoured cart with a leading section. Great effect this has on the soldiers, you know. General Horrocks, of course, we came to admire immensely later. He took over 30 corps, you know, I think in August, and did the thrust up towards Arnhem. But we got to know him and liked him immensely. But some of the other corps commanders, very early on, got a reputation for being unlucky.
What happened next to you after Operation Green Line?
Well, we pulled back, and of course we lost an awful lot of kit. We didn't lose many men. We lost an awful lot of kit with these battles down here, and so we were refitted. This took about a week, and during this week we saw the bombing of Caen. About 400 aircraft, Halifax and Lancaster Bomber Command came over at sunset one night and bombed Caen. And I thought to myself, what fearful destruction, and what a bloody business war is. In fact, this was the abiding impression I and so many had from the first experience on the battlefield. First dead man I ever saw in my life was a corporal in the Cameronians. I was particularly interested because my family raised the Cameronians years ago. And, of course,